Do you know what you get when you hire a Party Down catering team? At Party Down, we have a simple motto. It's your party. You deserve to enjoy it. But how are you going to enjoy the party if you're worried about whether the shrimp cocktail's been sitting out too long, or is there enough ice, or do the guests think the party is lame, or are they stealing stuff, or are they going through the medicine cabinet because they're nosy, or because they think they might find something that'll give them a rockin' buzz? I used to do that last thing. Not anymore. Clean and sober.
Wow, that is quite a motto.
TBTL!
This is stuff so funny, by the way.
Did the comic come up with this? Because some of this stuff, like, I feel like I could see somebody doing it in their act.
You go ooh and ah when I jump in my car. People treat me like this Hall of Fame L.A. Lakers center.
Oh, he's hilarious, dog. Who is Rick Moranis?
Are you all right?
No. No, I'm confused.
I want to be the bad boy of public radio, like Elvis Mitchell.
This party is going to be off of the hook.
All right, good morning, everyone, and welcome to a Tuesday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Everything about them just makes me nervous.
My name is Luke Burbank. I'm your host.
You're still doing a podcast?
Sure am. Right along up to episode 2855 in a collector series coming to you from the Burbank Springs Broadcast Center, perched atop Alabama Hill, Bellingham, Washington, the Bay City. Rainy, dreary, dismal day here. But word on the street is that this weekend, spring will finally arrive here in the Northwest. Blue skies, 60-degree temperatures. It's going to be gorgeous. And, of course, I'll be out of town. But for the people who are here, it will be very, very nice. I think we have a nice show in store for you today here on this Tuesday.
Let the fun begin.
We have a segment that I'm calling Dogs.
I'll say, what's up, dog?
In the snow.
Snow, and more snow.
In the news. Two different stories from the Iditarod. One about a guy who, for the second Iditarod in a row, this, of course, the famous sled dog race in Alaska. For the second year in a row, this French dude was leading towards the very end, and then...
And what happened next can only be described as insane.
Something happened to him, which once again deprived him from winning the race. Second year in a row, something insane has happened to the same French musher. And then this is why we can't have nice dreams. Another story about dogs in the snow in the news. This guy, a musician from New Orleans, had always dreamed of riding behind a team of sled dogs. And he finally got to live his dream during the Iditarod. And then things went real bad from there. The lesson being, never follow your dreams. So we'll talk about those things, and we'll do emails and v-mails, and we'll talk to this guy, the longest-running Cobra of the show. Known for his drawings of tall ships, their grace, and their splendor. He's white boy funk, just white boy hippie funk. And he wants to clarify one thing right here at the top of the show.
I am a proud boy.
He is Andrew Walsh, and he joins us right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my Cobra.
Good morning. See, I worry about context there. I'm not a proud boy. I am a proud boy. There's a difference, and
emphasis.
People are not listening to the emphasis or the inflection. I've done all I can to make myself clear.
Yeah. Other things that you'd like to clarify at the top of the show?
My brain is always pushing information out to make room for new information.
That's, I think, a good just kind of little thing to really establish here. One other thing.
If you're not supposed to be here, just give me a sign. Yeah, no, that's good, too.
Sure.
Those were both proud moments for me in the show yesterday. Good spoofs,
oh, as a proud boy?
I feel like, pulled off. So, thus adding to my proud boy status. I'm sorry, proud boy status. Damn it. See, that one's on me. I like this text message I got from you last night, by the way. You had just sent me the show sheet with the stories attached to it. And then you said, hey, you know what? I'm thinking about this, and I think it might be more fun for me to tell you about the top stories, so don't read them today. So I'm doing something very rare for me, which is not preparing for the show today. And
can I read to the listeners your response?
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah.
Done
yeah.
And done, but I should get a raise for this.
Right. This is hazard pay, man. You're asking me to actually not read the top stories before we go into this? I mean, I'll do it.
Based on the division of labor on this show, you probably should not be required to read any of the stories. It should be that the dynamic should be that I kind of tell you about stuff and then you just react to it. Because once the show is over, I am, you know, more or less footloose and fancy free. Well, realistically, I'm liberated to do my other 9 jobs. But you then spend a good couple hours with the show just getting it all sounding just right and putting in all kinds of metadata into the internet part of the show. And you do a lot of work. So the fact that you last night were able to, I'm just going to assume, play your video games and not read a couple stories about dogs in the snow in the news, I think that that's well-deserved on your part.
Yes, thank you. I'm writing down putting metadata into the internet part of the show as a possible show title.
Yeah.
So we're off and running.
I am a proud boy.
I was looking to see if anybody had sent us the actual audio of this, but if you don't mind, at the top of the show here, I'd like to give a shout-out to everybody who flooded our emails, our Slack channels, our Twitter feeds with the seemingly very direct TBTL reference on Jeopardy last night.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's interesting when it becomes clear to me when we've really flooded the zone on a particular topic. Yeah. When for a while it was Juggalos. I'm trying to think of some of the other examples. But like when we really get on, when I really get on to a topic repeatedly, then it'll pop up in the news and I'll just hear about it everywhere. And apparently I've really been on about this Luther Burbank situation because it was a question on Jeopardy yesterday, right? And I had people tweeting it at me. I had people emailing me. My Luther Burbank brand is strong.
It is. And also, I got to give credit, though, to the listener who wrote in, who works at the Luther Burbank house in what city in
it's
California?
It's a Luke.
House. I'll blame the delay on the line.
I just want to see if the longer I held the pause, if at some point it would break you and then you would jump in. I was willing to let that go for the next 53 minutes of show.
Just to hear the panic in my voice, would say, Luke, is there something wrong with the line?
See here. That's actually not a fair trick, because half the time it is a problem with the line.
The answer was, in 1875, this horticulturalist sold the potato variety later named for him for $150 and used the money to move to California.
I saw that stat, that dazzler of a DEET, and I was kind of... At first, I was like, WTF, man, the family legacy. You sold it for some magic beans. Wait, you crossbred some magic beans into a magic potato. Then you sold that for $150. But then I thought, that might have been a lot of dough back then. Like, and also, I guess he couldn't have known that it was going to become... I mean, I don't know enough about agriculture or agribusiness, but like, does that sound like he got ripped off? Or does it sound like, you know, that was actually kind of a good price for this hybrid potato at that time?
Like, what was Luther Russet slinging his spuds for back in the day, you know?
Well, the thing. It was the Burbank Russet potato.
Oh, that's right. It was it was the Burbank Russet. Damn,
they were the Bartles
were
and James of potatoes.
Right.
Now, is that a show title?
And it's an advertising slogan that I think they should embrace.
I miss those guys.
Those are the guys on the porch, right?
Yes.
Sit on the porch, rocking in their chairs.
I was very, as a kid, I was like, man, when I become drinking age, I'm... Here we go.
Hello there. My name is Frank Bartles, and this is Ed James. You know, it occurred to Ed the other day that between his fruit orchard and my premium wine vineyard, we could make a truly superior premium grade wine cooler. It sounded good to me, so Ed took out a second on his house and wrote to Harvard for an MBA, and now we're preparing to enter the wine cooler business. We will try to keep you posted on how it's going. Thank you very much for your support.
That's a pretty genius campaign.
Yeah, I think that holds up, actually. I find that really charming.
Yeah,
it's like
I assume those are actors, right?
I would assume. You know, one thing I noticed, so you know the commercial for, I think it was Harry's Razors, right? They started this commercial kind of campaign where the two guys who founded the company are kind of like, kind of earnestly talking into the camera about why they decided it was time to start a new razor company when they realized the markup on razors. So they bought the factory in Germany. And then did we just talk about this on the show, or was I having
more importantly, did we just run a Harry's Razor ad?
Yeah, right. That is. Do you know I still have some Harry's?
I do too.
Stuff that I use that I actually really love the smell of. But anyway,
they do not sponsor the show anymore. Although they may come back at some point. Who knows? But
yeah,
just so
hopefully.
You know, this is not paid content. What you're hearing right now.
No,
I mean we're getting paid, but we're not getting paid by Harry's.
But you know, they started this thing where it's like these two guys who are kind of like, you know, kind of tech bro-y, looking into the camera and being like, you know, we just realized that there's a problem in this part of the marketplace, and so we decided to fix it. I now realize that there's like 100 different commercials that are exactly the same, and you will see them all on MSNBC at any given moment. Like, there is one for the new watch company. There's a watch company where two guys
Movado
are staring
or
in the
something.
Camera. Something along those lines.
Yes.
It has
Bro-vado.
No one with an. It's got no vowels, right? Whatever the brand is, it's just
I know what she's like. It's like high quality watches for under whatever. Yeah, like those guys. They're real in the kind of like, I don't know. I'm going to start referencing people that the listeners haven't heard of. But there's this kind of certain like CrossFit bearded bro who's also like a titan of startup industry. And those guys are like right in that sweet spot.
And I saw... I meant to pull out a piece of paper so I could write them down because now, of course, the actual brands are slipping my mind. But I think that, well, they've been around for a long time, and they were a, I hate to say this word, but they were one of the early disruptors. But Warby Parker has an ad in that style now where I'm pretty sure it might even be two white guys staring at the camera doing the same kind of earnest pitch. And I saw two others yesterday. I'm like, wow, this is just a whole thing now. Just being like, we looked at the industry and we realized that the markups are just too much. Do you know what people are paying to have these things made? So we're cutting out the middleman. Like, that's it. That's what our future is. It's nothing but like two guys staring at a camera saying that they're disrupting an industry.
We figured out a way to mail Luke a pair of sunglasses that say Warby Parker on them that he will wear for up to 1 week before he learns that those are the samples and that you're supposed to. Like,
oh, right.
I was legit wearing sunglasses that said Warby Parker on the lens. I was like, I guess this is what cool people are doing. I don't know. Until I believe it was Vanessa said, yeah, that's not how that works. You decide if you like them, and then you mail them back in, and then they send you real ones.
Let me do this. I'm a fan of Warby Parker. I'm wearing a pair of Warby Parkers right now. They also advertised on the show at one point, and
but
maybe they would like to advertise
again. I sense a real
again.
Theme here. Like, a lot of former advertisers. This show is really littered with former advertisers.
Yeah. And the gloves are coming off today. I'm just going to go after all of their ad practices. In the Warby Parker commercial that I keep seeing, this is a TV commercial, they say something at the end that, and again, I love Warby Parker. Come back to TBTL. I'll cut this all out of the show. But they say something that I think is kind of misleading. If you know Warby Parker, this is how it works. You go online, you pick out some frames. They will send you, as Luke just said, 5 samples that you try on in your home. You decide which ones you like. You send all 5 back, and then they'll make you a pair with your prescription if you decide to choose one. But at the end of their commercial, they don't really explain that in all that detail. They just say, we'll send you 5 pairs for free. Which is technically right. They will send 5 pairs, and I assume that means no shipping on those 5 pairs. But doesn't that sound like you're getting 5 free pairs of glasses to keep? We'll send you 5 pairs for free.
Yes, yes, that is. To the uninitiated, that's exactly how that would sound.
All right, sorry. I took the show to boring town. I've just been
guess what?
This is not prep for ATM or anything. It was on my mind yesterday.
Well. let's dive deeper. The Bartles and James TV commercial starred two kind of like not actors, but they were not Bartles and James. Of course, it was a huge company that was in charge of this winery, I guess, or wine cooler company. They were played by David Ruftkar. He played Frank Bartles, and Dick Mogg played Ed James. David Ruftkar was a career Air Force veteran and cattle rancher from Redmond, Oregon. And Dick Mogg was a Santa Rosa general contractor. There was a talent search looking for regular guys to be Bartles and James. Those were the guys who were picked. I think that's pretty great casting. Flavors of Bartles and James included, and this is where I think it either gets very interesting, Andrew, or very boring very fast. Flavors include strawberry daiquiri, fuzzy navel, exotic berry, margarita, pina colada, classic original, tropical mango, blue Hawaiian, strawberry margarita, raspberry pomegranate, body shot lime, mojito, sangria, black cherry, strawberry. I'm a third of the way through for the record. Peach, raspberry cosmopolitan, strawberry hill citrus, and pink grapefruit, mountain berry, wild cherry, apple, apple blossom, blueberry, snow creek berry, sun peak punch. This is feeling like the people who named these things had all been fired from naming paint colors. Like, these all feel like variations on the same thing. Kiwi strawberry, blackberry ridge, tickle pink, pear and berry, peach bellini, lime cosmopolitan, salty persimmon, JFK blown away. What else do I have to say? Pineapple, banana cosmopolitan, raspberry. Andrew, discontinued flavors include blackberry, raspberry, daiquiri, strawberry cosmopolitan, melon splash, apple passion, orange sunset, red lime daiquiri, wild raspberry, wild grape, banana daiquiri, wild island, country quencher, spelled K-W-E-N-C-H-E-R. And the list goes on and on and on.
My only regret is that I didn't have the typing sound effect playing underneath that whole thing.
Oh, man. Hey, two quick things before we go to the break. One, we were unintentionally... Or I should say, unbeknownst to us, Andrew, we not only didn't catroll ourselves when we tried to go to the website crankyandy.com, we were catrolled in the most, I guess you could say, pure sense by listener Fam DeMort.
Yeah.
Because the other day on the show, I got an update from GoDaddy, which said that you're about to lose the URL crankyandy.com. And I asked you, should we save Cranky Andy? The website, should we throw another, I don't know what it is, $12 a year on that, put it on that color and spin the wheel and see what happens? And then you went to the website and it played the Game of Thrones theme as screeched by cats. And we laughed because I thought it was funny that I had essentially catrolled both of us. And then we got an email that clarified, no, you had not gone to crankyandy.com. You had gone, and I probably had directed you to the wrong place for the record. You had gone to crankyyandy.com. The extra Y stands for quality. Cranky Yandy. The extra Y stands for Yamberry, a discontinued flavor of Bartles and James. Anyway, crankyyandy.com is still very much in operation, and that is where the cat rolling happened, and that is because of our friend and super fam of the show, Lynn Pham. So I let Cranky Andy, I let that one wither on the vine, because really we don't need a Cranky Andy and a Cranky Yandy in our world, and Cranky Yandy is already being managed by the very competent Lynn. So that just a clarification on that whole point.
I have an idea. The next time somebody asks us what TBTL is about, I'm just going to hand them a thumb drive with the last 45 seconds of you talking on it. I'll be like, this is basically it. You know, pretty straightforward talk radio about whether or not we registered Cranky Andy or Cranky Yandy about a year ago. Like, every now and then our foolishness comes back and we're presented with us in the stark light of reality. And you're like, what the hell are we doing? I wouldn't say I had totally forgotten about that, but I certainly had forgotten about the details of our debate over whether it was Cranky Andy or Cranky Yandy.
What is TBTL about? What we try to do is sort of take the kind of top story of the day. We usually look around on social, just try to figure out what the buzz is, really what people are into. And then we really just try to do a lot of quarter hour maintenance, you know, sweep the dial and just try to maximize our TSL, and then that's about the first minute of the show, and then the rest is debating Cranky Andy versus Cranky Yandy.
But, you know, but let's just say we leave plenty of room for diversion.
We also like to have some fun. Sure. Sometimes one of the hosts will read literally 85 Bartles and James flavors.
And that's before they get to the discontinued list.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Let's take a break and get it together. Come back.
Let's all just settle down.
Everybody calm down. We'll come back. We'll tell you about dogs in the snow in the news. This is TBTL. Stay with us.
It's a dog-eat-dog competition.
No doubt.
I'll be gone like you wish.
And I'm out.
Because I ain't got time for hanging around when you find my love in all the wrong places.
It's a
dog-eat-dog competition.
No doubt.
I'll be gone like you wish,
and I'm out.
I like this. Who is it?
Yeah, De La. It's off of their album Stakes Is High, which I swear is one of the sleeperest albums out there. Like, everybody, I've never met anybody who's like, I don't like De La Soul. You know, everybody they're very accessible. But there's this one album called Stakes Is High that my friend Bob told me about a long time ago, and he's like, I'm telling you, it's their best one, and I think it might be their best one, at least that I've heard.
Was it,
yet, like, it doesn't seem to get a lot of love.
3 Feet and Rising, was that their kind of like most famous one?
Yeah, which also might be their first one as well. And those were the ones, I think they had two that were produced by Prince Paul, which kind of introduced skits and everything. And so it was like, and that's a sweet, sweet air. I mean, I love those records. But Stakes Is High is a little less jokey, a little less novelty thrown in there, a little less of that kind of stuff, and it's just more straightforward, and it's really good. On the topic of accessible hip-hop, I would like to say, I don't know if this is an apology to you, Luke. I'm not comfortable with that word necessarily, but I'd like to give you some ground on yesterday's outro music, because we went out with Slick Rick, and I was a little dubious. I'm like, there's a Slick Rick song that we can actually play on this show? Because he's known for working blue, incredibly blue. And I had never heard that party anthem. Let's Get Crazy? Is that
Let's
what it
Get Crazy, which I believe I was misidentifying as Let's Go Crazy, which, of course, is the exact title of the Prince song. But, yeah, Let's Get Crazy.
Well, unless things go sideways near the end of that, and I trust you that they don't, that's a fantastic party jam that the whole family can enjoy. You are absolutely right.
Yes, it is. I love that. So I forgot how much I love that song until you were playing it. For some reason, when you mentioned De La, I got in my head, do you remember the band Third Base? I was going to make a joke that said I was more of a third base guy myself, more of a third base head. Do you remember the song Pop Goes the Weasel by Third Base?
I feel like I only...
Oh, there's some skit at the beginning of this, so just to ignore this, but let's see here.
The weasel, I see the empty pocket needs a refill. I got a squad with a list of complainers. I should have started rape.
This whole video is making fun of Vanilla Ice. There's a fake Vanilla Ice in the video that they're calling the weasel. Except these are two other kind of, I don't know, how would I describe it? They appear to be white rappers themselves, but they're just like, but we're not Vanilla Ice.
I am watching the video now with you, and I remember this video more than I remember the song, but I completely remember this now.
He has this one part of the video where he's describing his rhymes, and he goes, complex structures like a pyramid, and he draws a pyramid with, like, his cane, I think. And I was just like, I don't know why that stuck with me for the last 30-plus years of my life.
This one guy looks like he is, like, on the very lowest rung of whatever Wolf of Wall Street scam was going on at the moment. Oh, my God. He looks
Gordon
like
Gordon Balfour.
Are those called boiler rooms, or what do you call those?
Yeah,
rooms
boiler room, exactly.
Yes.
Totally, because he's kind of like
he just got off work.
He looks like he auditioned for Color Me Bad and didn't make it in, but he's still wearing like a blazer. He's got
but
a blazer on. That's
to
his
the
look.
Bottle.
Right. I love this song.
Wow, I forgot about this.
Hey, look at that. Oh, shit. Are they in front of the Watts Towers in this video? noted outsider art piece, the Watts Towers at L.A.? That's hilarious.
I haven't gotten to that part yet.
I never knew what – I never knew – when I was a kid, I would have never known in Seattle what they were sitting in front of.
Oh, yes, they are. Yes, they absolutely are. Although that looks green screen to me.
Well, good for them or the video director for that's what they green screened them in front of instead of like a huge boat in Miami with ladies in bikinis. I like that they went with the Watts Towers.
Nice.
Real quick before we get to Donors of the Day, which we will be using third base as the music for OBS.
Oh.
No, we don't have to do that.
Who are the lucky donors? I think they'll love it.
MC Surge is the first donor on the
coincidence.
List. I had I wouldn't even it does not even rise to the level of basketball adventure this morning, Andrew, but it was a bit of a breakthrough. I'll try to keep this brief. So I told you that like I have kind of trying to bounce between two different early morning basketball games. One's at the YMCA where I do have a nemesis and also where my ball went missing. But to say that is misleading. It's where I stole someone else's ball accidentally and then a whole long involved story with me getting my basketball back unfolded. The other game that I played in one time and was loving is at the local high school, and it's a mostly teachers, I think, and it starts promptly at 6 a.m. And I went one time, and I like because I'd heard about this game. I showed up, and if the listeners remember, it's the kind of thing where you sort of have to be invited. You kind of have to know somebody there, and a guy that I had met at the YMCA had mentioned it and it said, yeah, you can just tell him that, like, you know me. But I wasn't sure if that guy was going to show up or not. So I had this whole like kind of rap ready in my head that I kind of a complex structure like a pyramid that I was going to lay on the people at the game to try. I was ready to talk my way in. And I showed up. This is like a few weeks ago. And there's just one little like side door in this huge high school gym. And it's just open, and I show up, and the guy goes, "You're the last one." And then I walk in, and then he just locks the door behind me. I was like, "What the hell?" It's like a basketball speakeasy or something. And it was like such a fun game because it's just you're just running your ass off from 6 in the morning until 7. Like there's like no waiting. Everybody, they have this really kind of odd way of doing it. If they have an odd number of people show up, that's just the numbers are just mismatched and they're just fine with it. So if you had 11, like today, there was 11 guys. So it was just like one team had 5 and one team had 6. And there were some special rules for the team with 5 guys. Like they could make 2-pointers. And like they're just, but it just worked because it's a bunch of guys who are my age and really our only goal in life is to try to break a sweat. If you make shots, great. If you don't, fine. Like it's really about exercising at some point. So anything that allows us to do the maximum amount of running during that hour is kind of the preferred way to do it. But the thing is, I have been to this gym, Andrew, no less than 4 times since I went the first time on days when I was under the impression the basketball was going to happen and nobody ever showed up. And I started to wonder if I had imagined that the game was happening or if they had moved it to avoid me coming back because
wow, you thought Pothead didn't like you.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out I have 19 nemesises, nemesis. I had 19 of them and they moved the game so I would not be able to get back in. No, I'm not kidding. So many mornings I would do this weird thing where, because the impression I had of the game was it starts at 6, at 6 a.m. it starts, the door locks behind them, and if you're not there, too bad. So I kept showing up at like 5:45. And I would get to the parking lot where I had gone the one time I'd gotten into the game and it was totally empty. And I would just be like, really? And so then I would leave and then I would go to the Y and just do like a different kind of workout because they don't have basketball every morning at the Y. It's only some mornings. So today I pull up and there's nobody. And I'm like, really? Because I know it's supposed to happen on Tuesdays. And like I'm sitting there and I'm kind of bummed because I'm like, I honestly think I might have hallucinated this whole thing because I've now – this is like the 5th time I've been there waiting. But I'm listening to Howard Stern on the stereo in the car and I'm like just, I don't know, cruising Twitter or something, writing a fire tweet about Mitt Romney eating Twinkies. And I kind of lose track of time and I guess it must have gotten to be closer to 6 a.m. because all of a sudden a car pulls up and a single hooded figure gets out of the car and starts walking. But he has shorts on. And I'm like, that guy's got to be going to a basketball game. So I like jump out of the car and like start kind of fast walking after him, but not running because I don't want to freak him out. And he's ahead of me by enough distance, Andrew, that it's like a 1960s espionage movie where there's like a slow speed chase through the streets of Paris where like a person is walking and trying to elude someone else, but they don't want to break into a run. And I'm like walking fast, but not running. And he's like walking fast. He doesn't know I'm there, but then he'll go around a corner and then I'll start running to get to where the corner is to like see where he's gone. And then right as I get around the corner, he'll be like going rounding another corner in the distance. We do like a full loop of the school this way because
he's on to you. He knows somebody's following him. And he's
and I'm trying to be not
right
creepy.
Now.
It is 5:55 in the morning and I'm jogging after a guy. I'm also, by the way, in a hoodie. I don't look unsuspicious at this hour, but I need to see what door he goes in because, like, I realize that there is some. I have somehow misunderstood what the system is, and like this guy is going to where basketball is happening, but clearly I've been going to the wrong place. So it is imperative I see what door he goes in, so I at least know the door we're using for this thing. And so I keep like running and I come around another corner and he's going up to the front door of the school because I guess it turns out he's the guy with the key. So he has to go to the like front door of the school, let himself in. And then he goes in and like turns on the lights in the gym and the whole bit. But I don't know this. So as I come around the final corner, now we're in the courtyard, the entrance to the whole high school. The dude is opening a door. And I'm like, if that door shuts behind him, I may never get into this game. And so I yell like, hey there. And he's like, stops and kind of turns around. I go, is this where the basketball game is? And he goes,
just like cool.
Yeah.
Just cool. Guy.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. Exactly. Is this... yeah, exactly. He's cool, Rick. He goes, yeah. I go, oh, okay. And you know me, I'll go into every situation with a plan to just be like chill and low key and the strong silent type. And that plan goes out the window immediately. And I go, okay, because like I've been coming a bunch of times. I went one time, I like unload my whole life story on this guy. Like,
I just go to the Y, and then they lost my basketball. And then they said it was going to be in the cabinet.
Like my nemesis.
Check the other cabinet.
He wears a Black Cat Cafe basketball team jersey sometimes. I don't know if he was on their team or what. I don't know if I can go back into the Black Cat Cafe because he might work there. Anyway, so I unload.
I was clearly saying Cranky Andy, and he thought I said Cranky Andy.
Are you familiar with the various canceled flavors of Bartles and James? So I like tell him the whole story of like, I went to the game once, but then I've been back a bunch of times. I don't know how to get into the game. Da, da, da. And he was like, yeah, just come with me. And then I'm like, cool. So then I just walk quietly with him through the school, which is totally abandoned at this hour. And then we get into the gym. And this is more or less the end of the story, which is just he said something to me in the hallway, though, that was very like to me, it was a big deal. I said – I was giving him the whole spiel and I was like, yeah, and I didn't know when it was. He goes, well, now you're in. And I was just like,
oh, wow.
Those were the magic words. Now you're in. I was like, oh, hell yeah. I'm in the brotherhood of people. And then it was actually really sweet because remember I told you like playing at the Y, part of what I like about these pickup basketball games is the social aspect. It's just kind of fun knowing a bunch of people, at least vaguely, you know, that you kind of spend a little time with. A few mornings during the week. And I come in and we're all kind of shooting around, getting ready to go, and the game's about to start. And this dude, Mark, who unlocked the place, said, hey, everybody, this is Luke. He came a bunch of times, but it was too snowy and we weren't having the game. And everyone laughed. And he was like, and he's here now. And everyone was like, hey, Luke, what's up? And then everybody but knew my name the whole game. It was like really great. I was like, cool. I like that. I feel like I'm kind of part of this crew now. And then, Andrew, and this is relevant. To all of the, or at least related to all the goings on with my basketball, the game's over. I was at the far other end of the gym getting my stuff together, and everybody else had kind of congregated where their stuff was. And somebody goes, "Hey, Luke," and I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Is this your basketball?" Because I had we were shooting around with my ball, and he rolls my basketball across the gym to me, and I was like, "These are my dudes."
Right. At any point, though, did you kind of like kind of relax and then kind of do that cool guy thing where you went to lean up against a locker, but your hand was sweaty, so you slipped and hit the ground?
That they don't have any lockers in that gym, but I did realize something, Andrew, which is that my high school, Jesus Creek, clearly plagiarized the most common high school fight song, because the fight song for Bellingham High is word for word the fight song from my school. And I promise you, Bellingham High has been around for longer.
Really?
Yes.
What's the fight song?
North Seattle Christian High, let's show them how we fight. For the glory of the Lord, we draw upon his might. Lions, lift your banner and let's raise, or lions, lift your voices and let's raise the banner high. How we love our alma mater, raise her banner, raise her banner, raise her banner high. Same song, minus the Jesus part and the North Seattle Christian, instead Bellingham. So clearly this was like pre-internet, what? But there was some book somewhere that was like, page one, yeah, use this for a fight song. Our fight song was verbatim what theirs is. And again, I know that Bellingham High has been around longer because I walked through the hall and they had like pictures of their like state champion basketball team from like 1924.
I do not know my high school's fight song. I'm ridiculously impressed with you knowing your high school's fight song. I just looked
it
up
here. It turns out it's the most common fight song in the country.
Here's what I got. This is from Wikipedia. This is the St. Ignatius fight song. I'm not setting you up for a joke here. I really have this on Wikipedia. I'm just making sure that, this is the Cleveland St. Ignatius. On Ignatius with your blue and gold. Nope, I've already messed it up. On Ignatius and your gold and blue, you're the best team that we ever knew. So far, I like the rhyming couplet. You've got what it takes to win this game. Honor to your name. Fight, you Wildcats of Ignatius High. Opponent's team can bid this game goodbye.
I mean, no offense.
You need to know the opponent's name.
No offense, but they should have just gone and stolen the boilerplate fight song that apparently every other school is using.
They should have stole the pump up Seahawks song by Lil Hoagie that we play for no point conversion. That'd be better, because you actually have
Saint Ignatius's other
name.
Opponent. There's some old cattle.
Yes. All right. On the old beam now, you blue and
it's
gold
still going.
Team now, and fight to victory. That's it. Yeah. It's actually not that long. I'm just kind of drawing it out, but that's pretty terrible. But then there's like an alma mater that I should know. Oh, yeah, but I'm not going to even attempt
what
that
about
one.
Walsh High? Because I know you spent time at both St. Ignatius and Walsh High. Can we do a side-by-side?
Walsh
and
Jesuit.
Yes, we've got you wishing we were reading Bartles and James Flavors.
That's
take that,
right.
Listeners.
I just want to make sure that I have the right Walsh here. So this might take a moment. It looks like there's
a few
of these. Okay. So what are you going to do while I look for this?
I'm going to tell people that this is mostly for our friend Chris Hayes, who said it's all the basketball talk. He'll eat all the basketball talk we can make.
I'm with him.
I started the game shooting 4 for 4 from the beyond the arc, as it were. And people were like, holy shit, this guy is good. I ended the morning 4 made shots for about 25 attempts.
You're like the Huskies.
Seriously. Well, you know what it is?
I don't follow college hoops that closely, but it sounds like you kind of – that represented the Huskies' season, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, hopefully their season's not done yet, but yeah, they've been fading. Yeah, the problem is even though I've been trying to be good about exercising, when you play basketball, if you're playing hard, your legs get tired, and you wouldn't think this, but kind of having energetic legs is kind of the key to making an outside shot, and so as you get more tired, you start to just kind of fling it up with your arms. It becomes less and less accurate, which was very much the case to me. After the first game, though, a guy came up to me and said, hey, good shooting. I said, don't worry, I'll regress to the mean. And I sure did. I certainly did. Okay, I just stalled.
Thank you. You bought me some time. Now, is there a chance that Walsh Jesuit does not have a fight song, that they only have an alma mater? Most schools have both?
I didn't even know alma mater, like a song called the alma mater was a thing. I never went to a school that was classy enough to have an alma mater. So that's like the school song that's not the fight song.
I believe so. Yeah. I mean, I found one video of it looks like the Jesuit. It just says Jesuit High School band fight song, but that's going to be just a marching band playing. And I don't even think that's connected to Walsh. This is from Walsh's page. Walsh Jesuit, Alma Mater, we raise our voice to thee. Thy cross and crown above us shine to guide us faithfully. With a warrior's heart and spirit and heaven's grace untold, may we be worthy of thy mission, fit to wear the maroon and gold.
See, that's not bad, because that's not
that's
a fight
song. That's not bad at all.
Like, you sing that in kind of celebration of the school. My issue with the St. Ignatius fight song was it just seemed like it'd be really hard to get, like, 300 to 400 people to sing that in unison, like,
seemed
certain
all
sections
over the place.
Of it. I didn't, you know, I came here to chew bubblegum and rank on the St. Ignatius fight song, and I'm all out of bubblegum. Did you guys ever say ranking on people when you were kids?
No.
He was just ranking on him. Ranking on him when I was growing up meant you were, like, making fun of someone.
Yeah, no, I like it, but I've never heard it. It sounds like it's perfect time for a comeback because nobody's using it, and it's a good verb.
I guess. It sounds kind of dumb now, all these years later, but it was a big thing. If our listeners who grew up in Seattle went to Seattle Public Schools, maybe I assume this was a kind of district-wide thing, but it was just like, oh, man, he was just ranking on him so hard. Yeah, that was and cap and burn. And then if you were talking about somebody got roasted or somebody was capping on someone, then you would, I know I've talked about this before, but you would do this thing where you would stroke your chin as if you were like a philosopher kind of playing with their thoughtful philosopher beard. But we were like in third grade.
Like a maester.
I'm yes, exactly.
To really get into Game of Thrones.
Thank you.
I'm doing everything I can to get us there. I have a
month. I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. Yeah, so you'd be like, oh, cap, bust. Like if someone capped on someone else, and then you would stroke your chin. I'm just imagining third graders doing this now, how ridiculous it must have looked.
Know.
Oh, you just capped on Danny Gator. Ooh, bust, cap, roast. As we're all sitting around stroking our chin in Mr. Wilburn's PE class. What a bizarro world.
Yeah, you don't realize you look like a third grader when you're in the third grade.
I, for the record, have the same amount of facial hair now that I did in third grade. So.
I was going to make a joke like that, but I feel like I ranked on your facial hair earlier in the week, and I want to spread that out.
You were just ranking on me so hard.
I got third base here.
Do you want to?
No. Yes, I want to.
Okay, all right. Oops. All right. Third base.
That was actually, I didn't even, wow, I don't even know what's, boy, I got all, I don't even know what's playing right now, but here we go.
All of that was like high school and middle school talk really took you back to a youthful place. Yeah, I want to.
Yeah, come on. Don't be.
Raw dryer.
Up goes the weasel.
Oh, no. You mentioned a skit before. Now I'm playing
this. Yeah, no,
this
is good, though. This transitions into it.
There it is.
Yeah. Actually, pretty good production, right?
That's all right. I mean, the rapping is pretty terrible. I got a squad with a list of complainers. I should have started rape.
Rappers against phony entertainers. So we can make it known that we won't get swayed. Ooh, except I just put the letters together in my head. That's actually not good. I thought you said rape, like with a T.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, no, wow. Coming out of the box strong there, third base.
Complex structure, like a pyramid. You know what we're not running here? A pyramid scheme. No, we're running a podcast that is supported by the donors of the show. And thankfully, all of your donations are held safely by American Public Media, a.k.a. Minnesota Public Radio, a verified 501c3. Do they rap about 501c3s at all in this song? Ooh, a little sledgehammer. You get that? A little Peter Gabriel sledgehammer?
Yeah, oh, that's what that is, right. I couldn't quite place it. Yeah, it's sledgehammer.
I would love to hear a whole rap about setting up a 501c3. You need to establish a board.
I almost guarantee you. I mean, I think you had one of these guys on your show. Remember in the God damn, when was it? Like in the mid-2000s, there was like nerdcore rap that was supposed to be like funny rap, but it was all about nerdy things. I'll bet made a...
Well, probably. Peace and love to that whole genre. We would play a lot of like MC Hawking, which was somebody had like taken Stephen Hawking's computer voice and then written songs about topics that Stephen Hawking had studied. It would be more... It would be just great if, like, it's one thing for people who are, you know, work as tax professionals to write, like, a funny song about, you know, what isn't deductible under the new rules. Like that,
sure.
Kind of, but it would just be great if a hip hop act that generally rapped about hip hop topics, just without explanation and apropos of nothing, just dropped a track about forming a 501c3.
Yes, actually, that could fit it. Like, Cardi B is at a place where she wants to kind of maybe park some money someplace.
Sure. That's not what you do with a 501c3. How dare you? You know who would do that song? Chance the Rapper, because he's all about building the community. He'd be like, here's how you can start a nonprofit in the community.
I was thinking less noble pursuits, certainly.
I'm thinking of the most noble pursuit, which is donating to TBTL, which is what the following people have done. And we want to thank them for helping keep this thing going. Kelsey Hudson of Lansing, Michigan. Becky Jameson of Shoreline, Washington. Adam Linegang of Bothell, Washington. Carol Millsap of Michigan City, Indiana. If you hit real Michigan, you've gone too far. Michigan City, Indiana. Nancy Bosiker of San Diego, California, where I will be starting tomorrow night. I am so excited, Andrew. I'm going to try to hike to something called Potato Chip Rock. It is listed as an
I have some bad news for you.
What?
No potato chips.
What?
No potato chips.
That's not why it's called Potato Chip Rock?
Yeah, no, that you try. There's a whole subreddit dedicated to people who are disappointed when they realize there's no potato chips.
It was
chips
Sun
up there.
Chip Rock for a while. They're trying to get healthier, but then they're like, eh, it's just the same thing. And it was Terra Chip Rock. They're like, nah, you're
baked
still deep
Lay's
frying.
Rock.
It's a root vegetable, but you're still just deep frying it. There's a reason it tastes good, because it's a chip. Anyway, Nancy, maybe I'll see you in San Diego. Margot Feather of Des Moines, Washington, as well. Margot, Nancy, Carol, Adam, Becky, and Kelsey. Thank you so much for listening to TBTL, and thank you so much for donating to the show. We would absolutely not be able to do this without you. Can you imagine a world where people were walking around not knowing about discontinued Bartles and James flavors? I don't want to think about that world.
I don't want to think about it, yeah.
And that world does not exist thanks to you. It's starting to get into double negative town, and I'm very confused. Yeah. What I want to say is thank you, Kelsey, Becky, Adam, Carol, Nancy, and Margo, for not making sure that this world doesn't not exist.
Hello, and welcome to Top Story.
Andrew, did you have a chance to read these
could
top
stories?
Could
you do that again? I don't think you could do that again.
I couldn't.
Could you repeat what you just said?
I just got into a flow state.
Oh, wow. I love it. That's what we're all aiming for. Whatever your brain was just doing right there.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry. What were you about to say?
I was going to ask, did you get a chance to read the top stories today? Because I'm going to lean on you heavily.
You know what? I studied them, and then I forgot them.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, when did you learn them?
Right.
Actually, I will try to not displace the top stories, although this is a bit somewhat germane. I saw a movie yesterday. It's on the subject of snow. I saw a movie yesterday called Arctic, which, if you are into these kinds of movies, as I am, it is really good. It's starring Mads Mikkelsen, who you've probably seen in a bunch of things. I always used to confuse him with Viggo Mortensen. He was in Star Wars, one of those Star Wars ones where he played somebody. I don't know. I'm so lost on who is, unless it's C-3PO and R2-D2, I literally don't know who anyone is on Star Wars anymore. But anyway, Mads Mikkelsen, he plays a guy who is playing he's a cargo pilot, and it crashes in Antarctica or in the Arctic. I guess we don't really know exactly where it is. And it's the story of him, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's basically the story of him surviving in the Arctic and trying to get out of there. And it's one of those movies where there's like no dialogue because it's just kind of a person against the elements, but it's just, I love that kind of shit. Like, I love books about that stuff. I am extremely here for that kind of content. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Arctic.
Can I give you a very weird half-baked review that will probably get us way off topic?
Please.
Try to keep this quick, though. I you were talking about Free Solo. Everybody was talking about the movie Free Solo. It didn't seem like a movie that would really appeal to me, so I have not searched it out. However, Genevieve had it on the other day. Now, a couple of caveats. I didn't watch it from the beginning. I probably watched about an... I watched a really big chunk of it with her, but I did not watch it from the beginning. Number two, I was admittedly in a bad mood for unrelated reasons, but I hate it. Like, not from a filmmaking perspective, I didn't hate it, but I just, Free Solo just pissed me off the whole time in an irrational way. Like, I just like freaking stop doing it. It's stupid. Well, like, there are a million things that people can do where they put their life on the line. And you know, and then when you're putting your life on the line, you're affecting the people around you, yet somehow we act like the people who do this are more noble than the people who do really dangerous, stupid stuff on the streets. Like, I don't know. I just got really angry at everybody in this movie.
Oh, did it trigger a fear of heights, or was that maybe part of it?
I mean, I am super scared of heights. I didn't watch it on the big screen, so I don't think I had, like... I mean, it was really, really impressive, obviously, and you know. But I don't think it was... Like, I didn't get vertigo watching it. It wasn't that. Okay. I just, like... Maybe, if anything, it might have been more of a... I don't know. Maybe it was preying more on my own insecurities about me not doing anything huge in my life. Maybe that's really what's going on. Who knows? But all I know is I was irrationally... angry at the movie and at this guy, and I don't think you're really supposed to like his girlfriend anyway, but she was really...
I think you're supposed to like her, I guess. I don't know.
Are you really?
Well, I mean, it's a documentary.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's exactly the dynamic they've set up, but if I could just very briefly make the argument for why I think what he did is different than somebody just recklessly taking chances with, like, doing... excessive amounts of drugs, or, you know, something else that's very dangerous to themselves that we don't make documentaries about where they're exalted. As a person who recently found a not so secret trail off a logging road, Andrew, I think I can identify with Alex Honnold's journey to the top of El Cap. I guess I feel like there's something about the intentionality behind what he's trying to do and the sense of personal accomplishment and happiness that he feels from getting from succeeding that it somehow feels... I wouldn't go so far as to say it's noble, because you're right, he's putting himself in real danger. And what I liked about the film was I thought it actually did a pretty good job of showing how much his decision to try to do this, how much it really messed with his actual friends. There's some shots, I don't know if you... we're watching at this point or not, but there's some of his friends who are there to help film it. They're part of this crew, this elite climbing crew that was – I mean, just to be able to film this, they had to be themselves world-class climbers. There, you see what the effect really is on the people who are around him, and it's harsh. You know what I mean? Like, it really – it's really emotionally super-duper – intense for them. You don't get I didn't walk away from the movie thinking, like, that was no big deal or high fives all around, he did it. I've finished watching the movie and thought, man, he really effed with the emotions of his friends and girlfriend. So I don't think I disagree with you on that point. I guess I just think there is more upside potentially, or it's somehow more, I think, defensible than just putting yourself in really extreme risk for just because you want to get crazy high on a bunch of 9 different, you know, substances or something, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, everything you say makes sense, and rationally, I know all of that, and rationally, I think the filmmakers decided to make a film about an interesting topic and explored those things. I don't think it was a bad film. I don't think that it overlooked those aspects at all. But for me, watching it, it was just a very unpleasant experience. In the same way that maybe there would be, like, some art film that shows slicing up eyeballs or something, and it would
totally...
it would put you in a really bad place. Like,
absolutely.
This just put me in a... I was a little cranky Yandy. I think that was
Were you cranky
Saturday,
Andy,
maybe?
Or cranky Yandy?
Oh, shit. Hold on. Let me look it up online, see if there's a website that clears that kind of stuff up. But, yeah, so I just want to tell you that. And, again, it's not me saying you shouldn't watch this movie.
I think it's saying
something more about, like what triggers me. And somehow this movie just triggered me.
I get it. I can appreciate where you're coming from. I think we've all got stuff like that where – and I do that a lot, actually. I did it a lot more when I was drinking, honestly, where, like, something – this is why Carrie didn't like watching TV with me. And I'm not trying to compare my not great behavior with your behavior. I'm not trying to assign a, I don't know, moral quality or whatever to your behavior. But I would sometimes just decide early on in a show that a character was bothering me or something was unrealistic, or if it was like a quote-unquote reality show, but I could see how it was unreal. I would just get like real kind of sour about it and then just – it would just build. And then of course, everything I see is confirming why I'm already annoyed with the programming. And sometimes, you know, it was justified and sometimes it wasn't. It just had to do with my mood. So I can totally identify with what you're talking about. And I mean, it's weird to think that if that guy keeps doing stuff like this, he'll probably die up there. You know, I mean, he really will. And even to the point where, you know, they set up a lot of remote cameras because none of them could – handle being the person filming their friend dying, because of course nobody would want to go through that, or could it be very hard to deal with. So yeah, I mean, it is a weird thing, and I don't think your feelings are totally completely unjustified with that.
That maybe is part of the thing too, is like what is the difference between what he's doing and a sort of drawn out suicide, because you do sort of feel like that is the only logical conclusion to this. Like, the way his brain is right now, unless something very chemically different happens in his brain, he's only going to keep doing this until he dies, and chances are his friends might film it. And because I just don't see a scenario where he's kind of like, well, okay, I did it, and now I've climbed a bunch of mountains, and which is, I guess, is not really climbing mountains, but whatever. And now I'm going to just retire, and I'm going to start selling baskets, and then I'll retire, and then I will, you know, die peacefully in my bed. Like, that's not going to happen. He's only going, like, it sort of seems like he's only going to do this until he kills himself, and he's basically got a support network for that plan. And well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's,
I will say that he did in the movie, he did like start the big climb that he was going to do and then abort it because he just didn't feel right. So I don't
think.
So maybe that same. And the other thing I guess I would say, knowing almost nothing about that world other than what I saw in that movie, I guess I did interview him once and read his book, so I know a little bit about it. But like, part of why he's really good at this is because he's obsessive with his preparation. So now the downside for him is the only way that he's going to like LeBron James is learning this season that he's not quite as good at basketball as he used to be. His, you know, age is catching up with him. He's still very good, but he's diminishing in his abilities. The way that Alex Honnold is going to realize that his abilities are diminishing is as he is, you know, falling to the floor of Yosemite National Park or something, off of a very high place. So that's the bummer is if he keeps pushing himself to the absolute extreme and then he's the last one to figure out that he's not quite as good as he used to be, that will probably mean death. That being said, he is pretty obsessive with his preparations, and so I think part of what a lot of those climbers will tell you is that they don't consider themselves to be risk takers because they over, like, there's another guy who's kind of his Tommy. Oh man, I'm not gonna be able to remember the guy's last name, but there's a guy that he climbs with a lot. In the movie, and who I heard interviewed on Fresh Air, who's a Caldwell, Tommy Caldwell, maybe. Anyway, same deal. That guy's like whole thing is, look, I'm obsessive. I know that my life depends on it, so I'm obsessive about preparing and practicing with ropes and kind of really trying to avoid dying. And so I guess their argument would be it's not as risky as it looks because they're over prepared. You know, for what that's worth,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah, no, that's good.
Okay, so to this movie, Arctic, it's really good. I highly recommend it. When I was a kid at Washington Middle School, where I don't know the fight songs, I didn't go there very long. I remember we had this. I took like a home ec class, and Miss Bothell, the teacher, was reading to us this book called Hatchet that was about a kid who's in a Cessna flying in Canada. Like, he's not flying the plane. He's a passenger. I think his parents are divorced, and he's going from one rural place to another, and the plane crashes. The pilot dies, and this kid's living out in the middle of nowhere. And this the story of this kid trying to survive, and I just was, like, so I just was riveted by the story. So I've always loved those kinds of stories of survival. I would die immediately, for the record. I mean, I don't even kid myself. Like, the stuff that Mads Mikkelsen is doing in this movie, his whole schedule to stay alive and all the things he's doing, it's amazing. And I'm just like, yeah, no, I would pretty much – I would root around in the plane to see if there was any liquor. And then when that was gone, I would just lie down in the snow and say goodbye to the world. But if you like movies about survival, I would recommend Arctic. It's really, really good.
One question.
Yeah.
Do you think your home ec teacher was phoning it in? Mm. Why was your home ec teacher just reading to you young adult novels in front of the class?
Well, I would say she was phoning it in, but she was reading. Really phoning it in would be film strip or
that's true.
A yeah. movie. This is how old my ass is. I remember being a little kid, and we didn't even have movie. Like, we didn't even have, like, TVs. We had film strips. Do you remember film strip?
Yes, I'm pretty sure we had those in grade school. Probably by the time I was out of grade school, it was all moved to a TV-based phoning it in system. But yeah, but I mean, because right? it's at the point where I can't kind of separate my memories from the trope of, like, the film melting on the hot bulb. You know, like, that's kind of a trope that you'll see often depicting classrooms from long ago. You'll
but
see
when I say film strip,
down.
You know, I don't mean a moving picture. I mean a slideshow.
Oh shit! Yeah, I remember those because they would assign somebody in the classroom to flip the page when you heard the tone. They had the tone, doot, and then you would flip it. Right.
This was some kind of weird, rigid series of basically like slides that would be in a strip. That was why it was called film strip, and it was basically like the Grand Canyon, and you put it in this weird machine that would – it was like, you know, you were watching a slideshow, but the slides were connected to each other because it was part of a lesson plan. And there would be this, like, machine would click through, but it wasn't a typical slide projector because I remember these being – these film strips looking kind of like, you know, when you go in a photo booth and you get those pictures. It basically yeah. looked like that, but the photos were slides. And I remember it being a thing where if the teacher, like, couldn't get the TV because there was, like, one TV in the school, then it was film strip time. It was like – we were like, oh, God, film strip. Okay. So that's phoning it in. If Miss Bothell was phoning it in, she picked a hard way to do it. I don't know why she was reading. That seems like if you're hungover or you don't want to be there, you're bored. I was all of those things in eighth grade, by the way. That's not true.
So the connection, though, to the text, Hatchet – the actual content connection to the curriculum was just because it showed you how to do various home ec things like cook and I guess it sounds like a survival story. How did it tie into home ec?
Zero. No relation to home ec whatsoever. I mean, it was like made no sense as a home ec. Really, I mean, he didn't like bake bread out there. He didn't do any macrame.
Uh-huh.
There was like nothing. No, it was just, I guess she just wanted to read this book to us. And I was, like I said, I really enjoyed it. Now, it may not have been every day. It might have been like a Friday, you know, treat kind mm-hmm. of a thing. Like, now we're going to read a little bit. But I really, really enjoyed it. And that was sort of, you know, I also have talked so many times about my favorite articles from the Reader's Digest, Drama in Real Life.
Yeah,
which
I did.
Kind of similar stuff. I loved that as a kid. So. So if you like me, if you're kind of fascinated by that sort of content, I would recommend Arctic. I would not recommend, if you are ever racing in the Iditarod, I would not recommend letting your dogs fight with each other when you're leading the race because it might lead them to actually quit. And you might go from leading the race by 5 hours to hanging out on the side of the trail as all the other mushers pass you with their dog team. This is exactly what happened to a guy named Nicholas Petit. He was leading with, like, I don't know, a couple hundred miles left of this, like, 1,300-mile race. He was leading by 5 hours. He was in like one of the final sections of the race, and his dogs quit on him. And he thinks it's because a couple of the dogs started fighting with each other, and then he yelled at the dogs, which I guess he never does. So now he was telling the people interviewing him by phone or whatever that the dogs just decided they weren't into racing anymore. So he was sitting on the side of the trail, waiting for the dogs to get it together. Now, here's what's crazy. Last year, he was leading, going into the final leg, and he misread the map and GPS and took a wrong turn during the Iditarod and lost the race.
Wow. I got to say, though, I mean, you look at it, I guess, from the dog's perspective, and I think I would definitely get to a point where I'd be like, what the hell are we doing here? And it sucks for him.
Now, that's the thing. PETA, which we've talked about a lot on the show, particularly when the Feed Two Birds with One Scone story came rolling down the pike. PETA takes issue with the dog racing in general and said, because he said it's a head thing, meaning the dogs are just kind of like not into it. It's like in their heads. PETA says it's not the dogs who need to have their heads examined. It's anyone who supports this merciless race. Illness, injury, or fatigue likely prompted Nicolas Petit to drop four dogs from his team, forcing the remaining 10 to work even harder before they gave up together, which he blamed on just a head thing. So PETA is saying that the dogs quit because this was too hard. I just don't know enough about the dogs in this case, about any of this topic at all, to know if these dogs love doing this or if they hate doing it. I have to say, I didn't grow up around people riding horses. I didn't grow up around, obviously, dog mushing. I didn't grow up around a lot of these things where animals are doing work. And I know that people that do grow up around it and are familiar with it will talk about how the animals really enjoy doing the work. That gives them a sense of purpose. I heard a guy being interviewed on NPR the other day. Of course, he's very much biased in this, but he was he's the head of the horse racing association in the state of California. And, they shut down Santa Anita because horses keep dying there. And he was saying, well, these horses are highly calibrated athletes, and they not only want to run, they need to run. And I was like, do they? They might need to run around in the pasture, but do they need to run with a small Guatemalan man on their back? Do they need that? I'll admit that I don't know enough about any of these industries or any of these sports that I'm talking about. I think if you talked to people who race, sled race dogs, they would say that the dogs love the challenge. I certainly think these people love their dogs. I think that they are very, very, very bonded with these animals. Just like I think people that race horses and ride horses really love their animals. I don't think that there's any intentional cruelty, but I always just kind of wonder, when people say that, oh, no, that horse loves pulling that carriage through Central Park, I'm like, would the horse do it, as a hobby? Again, I don't know. I don't understand the psychology of animals enough to really have an informed opinion on the matter.
And I'm going to get in some dubious territory here, too, because I don't feel strongly about it either, because, like you, I will admit, I'm, not very informed about it one way or the other, but it just seems like a dubious argument to say, but these horses, they need to run, man. We're doing them a favor. But it's like, yeah, but these horses only exist because you bred them. You're creating a whole – you are creating the problem. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that horses wouldn't exist if we stopped breeding them for horse racing. But I'm just saying that you literally created these horses for one function in a very specific environment. So stop doing that. Right. I mean, would be, I guess, the other argument.
These pugs love to hang out in the bed. Yeah, because you bred them to sit on your feet and keep them warm, and they can't breathe.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I will say that, this is the lamest comparison of all time, but it's just the one that I can make, I guess. When I see those dogs, running, pulling the sled, they seem, pretty invigorated and pretty, engaged in the process, in the way that if I'm out with Rudy and we're going up a steep hill, or just she's doing something where she's working really hard. Now maybe this is just has to do with the physiology of the face of a dog, but they have like a pretty happy look on their face. Like Rudy will be running and her tongue will be lolling out the side of her mouth and she'll just like look like she couldn't be happier. And she will keep going for it and going for it and going for it in this way that like she could just stop. Like she's Rudy has quit. And I know that like me and the dog walking in our neighborhood is nothing compared to what's going on in Alaska. But like Rudy and I have been on walks in the neighborhood where it's kind of warm out, like just walks. And she'll just stop. She'll just like sit down and be like, I'm not doing this anymore. But if we're out in like the wilderness, she will like run up like the sheerest, like, you know, steepest hill. And like she never quits out there. Like she likes it, I think, because I think because she knows that quitting is an option because she does do it sometimes in other circumstances. So, again, I don't have any insight. That's probably a terrible comparison, but I don't know. I know that I tend to think that this PETA's a little bit – PETA's job is just always sort of try to provoke a conversation about anything involving animals, which, you know, I guess to their credit – like I'm more on PETA's side of a lot of these things than I used to be. That's for damn sure. But in this case, I don't know. I think that these mushers love these dogs. I think they're close with these dogs. I think the dogs are pretty happy. I don't think that there's no whipping of the dogs as far as I'm aware of. Like, I think it's kind of a pretty fun, grueling, challenging thing for everybody and every dog involved.
They don't whip the dogs? I guess I hadn't really thought about that. I guess I picture like the old timey cartoons, but I don't
know
what
goes
on out there.
Those, I mean, they have those, they have some, there's some reins that they like tie up to the sled that I think they could probably take off and hee-yah. But I don't, you know, I don't think they have like a, you know, like some kind of a whip like that they hold in their hand that they actually like, whoosh, you know. By the way, other dogs in the snow in the news. The story of a guy named Yotam Haber. He is a music composer. He is a professor at the University of New Orleans. And he has for his entire life been obsessed with dog sled racing. As evidence, this is a Washington Post story, by a photo that the Washington Post includes in the article about what happened to this guy, of him as a kid in Minnesota with a sled he built himself and neighborhood dogs that he had collected together.
Oh, no.
I don't know if those dogs were into it or not. Yeah. It's like the idea, like a basset hound and then like a Great Dane and like a Shih Tzu. And like, what are we even doing here right now? Inhibiting.
Where's Peanut Butter? Have you seen Peanut Butter? Yeah, no, exactly. I don't know. The neighbor kid said he wanted to take him for a walk. No problem.
I might be quoting like – this might be the plot of Snow Dogs. I haven't seen Snow Dogs, but there's a good Disney movie in a story about a bunch of actual neighborhood dogs that win a dog sled race, like non-huskies. Yeah, right. There's a really good movie in that. So
cool mushings.
this guy is has always been really, really a kind of interested and intrigued with the whole idea of dog race or, you know, dog sled racing, I should say. But, you know, he's a musician, he's a composer, and he's he did not pursue the life of being a musher. He pursued the life of music. Well, it turned out that I think it's like his wife was friends with a woman or maybe the husband of a woman named Blair Braverman. And Blair Braverman is kind of become internet famous. She is a musher. A sled dog racer, but she's also like very kind of social media savvy. Somebody, I guess, said something mean about her online, called her, I think either called her dogs ugly or called her an ugly dog. So now that's the hashtag for her, and all of her followers are called ugly dogs, and everybody have really taken the term back. And I've actually seen this Blair Braverman woman's stuff popping up on Twitter because there must be people I follow that follow her. So she sort of became friends with this guy, Yotam. And so basically there was an opportunity for him to come up and ride along with her for the kind of ceremonial parade of with her dog sled as the Iditarod was about to kick off. And then after that, he went up to this, I guess you could call it like sort of farm preserve. It's like 63 miles in the interior of Alaska. You can't get there other than like ATV or snowmobile, and he was up there to just kind of like keep taking care of these sled dogs, and he'd been sending all these pictures, and he was just living his dream, Andrew. And then the other day, he takes the dogs out, and apparently he fell, like he sort of I'll just read it to you. And this is a little bit gross. Sorry, everyone. So just, you know, fairly warned to be thee. On the third day, as he was being pulled down a steep slope by an exuberant team, he made a mistake. Rather than riding the brake with 2 feet, he rode with only one, creating enough of an imbalance that the sled tipped over. By the way, that would happen to me in minute two. I know that if you put me on the back of that sled, with my history of questionable boat piloting, within 2 minutes that sled would be on its side and I'd be being dragged behind it. There's no way that I would not screw that up. It seems like a very complicated
thing. Because you think
thing.
That you'd try to go too fast, or you just think that it's just a tough thing to do?
I just think it's tough. There's all of this force being generated by these dogs running, and if you kind of don't really know how to control them with your voice and stuff, it's just this giant, you know, it's just huge engine of work being done by these dogs, and you're being pulled along on this thing, and it just feels like you're sort of riding on the back of a rocket ship, and I just know that I would immediately screw it up, kind of like this guy did. Every musher has it drilled into them that rules 1, 2, 3, and 4 of dog sledding are the same. Never let go. So that, Andrew, in case you ever find yourself in the situation, that is rule 1, 2, 3, and 4 of dog sledding is never let go.
Never let go.
Okay. I don't really know why. I guess maybe the dogs would just run forever.
Yeah, maybe then you're left out in the middle of nowhere with nothing but a hatchet.
I guess they wouldn't. Maybe the dogs wouldn't realize that you're not on the sled anymore. So they'll just like keep going. Because that's the other thing. My first instinct 1, 2, 3, and 4 for me would be let go of the goddamn sled.
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly. I have a rich, full life beyond dog sledding.
Yo, let me know when you guys hit Mads Mikkelsen by his downed plane, you've gone too far. Circle back.
Right.
Like, I don't know why that's the rule. That just seems like a recipe for disaster. Guess what? It was, Andrew, for this guy. So he's lying on his side. He's being dragged along by the dogs, and his grip is starting to slip. So he reaches up and grabs the only thing that he can see to grab, something called, wait for it, a snow hook. That doesn't sound dangerous at all.
Mm-mm. Right.
It's a heavy piece of metal used to anchor the sled in the snow. His right index finger gets jammed into it, and he watched as his right index finger snapped off. His finger snaps off in the snow hook. And I assume, I don't know how he kept holding on or if the sled just departed with his finger on it.
Oh, my.
This is kind of crazy, though. He said his first feeling was disappointment that his Alaskan dream was surely over.
I would think that my first reaction would be, oh, shit, my finger.
Yeah. Side note, I'm a composer. I believe he plays piano, Andrew.
Oh, played.
This was like when Peter Williams and I were carving walking sticks while camping as kids. He was a really, really talented cellist and now is actually teaches cello at the Suzuki School in Seattle. Went to the University of Indiana, which is like one of the best orchestra programs in America. His hands were everything. His fingers were like, you know, the key to this whole thing was his whole life was playing cello and whittling, apparently. And I watched him as he went to try to carve the top of this eagle and just in slow motion slipped and just like thwack. I saw the knife blade into his index finger of his hand that he would have to like press down on the strings with, not his bow hand, but the other one. I watched the pocket knife go about 80% of the way through that finger. And I just and I had the same thought. Our Alaskan adventure is over.
I have two passions in life: to be a highly trained cellist and to be an amateur whittler.
Some people have like, said these dreams are in opposition to each other. Right. Some people have described as each other's natural enemies.
And just to be clear, he's also the guy who you knocked a tooth out of by throwing a remote control or a video game controller.
Nintendo controller.
He's always wanna. He's like a recipe
for disaster. And then we lied to his mom and said, because we knew that I would never be allowed to come over again if she understood the origin of his injury. We lied to his mom and said that his tooth got knocked in half while we were playing basketball and that he had swallowed it. And she famously said, I will dig through shit to find the rest of that tooth if it saves me $400. So we like to say that with the Williams family. If I saw Diane Williams now, I would say that to her. She would maybe laugh. I think that maybe the statute of limitations has expired on it. But
would
anyway,
she remember? Or would she just
Oh, she would remember Peter's
person.
Tooth getting broken. Oh, I mean, that was oh, a yeah. pretty that was a pretty crazy yeah. thing to have happen. And Peter was, of course, upset because the story was the whole premise of the story was that he was so uncoordinated that a basketball hit him in the mouth and broke his tooth. And he was like, he really didn't like that. He said, like, we got to come up with a better cover story that does not involve me being that uncoordinated.
I mean, he had such Stockholm syndrome for you, too, though, because, like, if you'd done that to me, like, in the moment, I'd probably be like, I would just be like,
really
goodbye. I'd be like, you're right, Mom. I shouldn't hang out with this asshole anymore.
This is because this is like I was the Tony and he was the Andy, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. I wouldn't have kicked you out. Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't take any joy from – like, I certainly didn't intentionally. Like, this was not a bully – as I remember it, we should just have him on the show. To me, this was not a bullied relationship. It was we were friends, and it wasn't like we didn't. I didn't get together with other people and gang up on him. But I did. You know, we would like all we did all day long was weird physical challenges. In fact, we called it physical challenges. So it would just be like set up the camcorder and get a workout trampoline and put it out of the frame and then jump off the trampoline and dunk a basketball and hang on the rim, but so you couldn't tell it was off a trampoline. We had a whole thing we called dives where we would set up a camera and we'd throw baseballs to each other just out of our reach, so we had to dive with our mitt and catch it, and then we would videotape it. We would have to place our hat on our head so that it would fall off as you were diving, a la Ken Griffey Jr. running after. Like, it's just hours of this kind of bullshit. And in all of that, although I can't blame the Nintendo controller thing on a physical challenge. That was just me being an asshole kid. Well, it was him being kind of a jerk to me, but me taking it way too far in response. But anyway, back to Yotam Haber, who I know he's a composer. So he composed, I believe he plays an instrument as well. For some reason, my mind says piano. Whatever it is, as a composer, as a person who plays music, as a person who presumably plays an instrument, having all 10 of your digits is sort of advantageous. And watching one of them become disconnected in a snow hook on a runaway sled is, we'll call it, suboptimal. So this is the crazy thing about if this kind of thing goes down in Alaska, is that, as we already mentioned, he realized his Alaskan dream was surely over, and then the Washington Post writes, getting out of Alaska proved a much longer journey than getting there. Haber jammed his finger back into place somehow. The lodge owners, sorry everybody, I can feel your bungholes clenching from here. Lodge
thanks for making it worse.
That's not what you do when you hear a story like this. I feel like goosebumps and my bunghole tightens up for some reason.
I just meant thanks for making the show worse by saying the word bunghole.
Twice. He jammed his finger back into place somehow. The lodge owners swaddled his hands in towels, and they began an eight-hour wait for a helicopter that never came. He finally got out by Snowcat, which the Washington Post clarifies is a Jeep fitted with tank-like treads. And I'm like, we all saw The Shining. Okay, yeah, we all saw right. Dick Halloran driving a snowcat. We don't need an explanation. Thank you very much. Would you like some ice cream, Doc?
wow, I didn't know you were hanging on to that one. I didn't know you had a Scatman Crothers imitation.
2,854 episodes I've been waiting, lying in the cut.
Some people just shine.
I love the like blaxploitation porn in Dick Halloran's house in, I think it's like Florida somewhere.
Oh,
when
right,
they
right,
call
yeah.
him, or actually I should say, I think he's calling the authorities because he can't get a hold of the Torrance party in the Overlook, and he's nervous and he's on the phone, he's talking to the authorities, and then he's kind of like, I think my memory is they just pull out. He's in his home in Florida, and behind over his bed, I think, is just a giant painting like of a nude black woman. And like, I just love the idea of Dick Halloran's love shack in Florida. Just anyway, So we know what a snowcat is. They get him in the snowcat, and then it takes 4 hours in the snowcat to get to the road where an ambulance was waiting, and that drives him to Fairbanks. That's 3 hours away. Imagine your finger is detached, and you wait 8 hours for a helicopter that doesn't come, and then you get in a snowcat with Scatman Crothers for 3 hours, and then you get – sorry, 4 hours. And then you get to the road, and then it's 3 hours on the road in the ambulance. Is there a point where your finger has actually re-knitted itself to the hand? Has the finger healed at some point?
I don't know how that stuff works. I don't think so, though.
All right. Well, you're
right,
my friend.
I don't even understand, like, when a finger is completely removed, I don't even understand what it means to, like, jam it back in place. Like,
I think there was actually a flap.
Now,
as I read the story more carefully, I think there was a flap of skin still attached.
Mm,
okay. So, yeah.
Glad I asked.
For me, which is nice. So then he goes, he gets to Fairbanks, where a doctor sewed the finger back in place provisionally. If your finger is ever being sewn back on provisionally, you got probs. This is just phase one of the reattachment of the finger. They recommended he go back to the lower 48 to get the thing fully fixed. So he takes a plane back to Louisiana. He gets there. He was taken to surgery. And he will learn, actually today, Andrew, if the surgery has been successful.
Thinking good
thoughts for Yotam Haber, who, by the way, seemed to take this whole thing in stride. He's actually seemed pretty cool. He wrote to the followers of Blair Braverman, "Dear hashtag ugly dogs, heartfelt thanks for your many well wishes. From the morning of my accident," he had attached a picture to this post. He said, "This pure joy that I get to share with you. Like all of you, I am continuing to follow Blair's courageous race at every turn." He wrote that from New Orleans after he'd had his finger hopefully successfully reattached. So he doesn't seem to be too bummed out about it. I guess he's taken it in stride.
Yeah, I guess so. And yeah, I was purposely not reading too much into these stories per my TBTL contract, but I'm looking it up now to see if there are any updates. But I do see it's all over the place, but I don't know if there's really any definitive updates on how that finger is doing. Pianist,
it's kind of funny.
Finger.
While he was waiting for the helicopter that never came, he said, "I contacted the head of Argento Ensemble, and I said to him, I've never missed a deadline on a commission, but I don't think I'm going to be able to finish this one." He is also left-handed, and he lost the finger on his right hand, so that's kind of a it's also a positive. If it's not okay, it's not on his primary hand, so there's that.
All right, I know you know about TBTL the podcast. You're listening to it right now, but have you tried TBTL the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week, I hope that it's from a female. Oh, man. It's not from a female.
Oh, hold on, Andrew. I missed three Bartles and James flavors. Here, let me just...
Let's not sleep on those. What do you got?
No, it's not. I don't have any. Thankfully, for everyone, I have now clicked out of that page. Any emails and or Vmails of interest?
Well, remember how yesterday I said I was going to check the voicemail line and see if we had any updates on all those mysteries that people had, a smell-related mystery, a parking-related mystery, and a missing garbage can-related mystery? Well, when you said don't read the top stories, I figured you also meant don't check any emails or V-mails either. I just want you to relax, play some MLB baseball, and don't worry about those things. So,
what team are you when you play MLB baseball?
Oh, Mariners, always. Now, because I'm playing a season, so it's like you can choose how – I don't even know what I have it set to. You can play a full 162-game season or half that or a quarter season. And I just picked up this game again. You know, I'm just a child, basically. When baseball's in the air, then I start playing my baseball video game again. And mostly it's something to do. You really don't have to think much when you're playing this game. So I just listen to podcasts and kind of zone out. But, yeah, so I'm like five games into like a Mariners season. I'm assuming it's a full 162.
Can I clarify something?
Mm-hmm.
I think I may have besmirched King Felix yesterday. Because I said that he was, like, angry that he wasn't the starting pitcher on day one for the Mariners. And yeah, I think that that was not – I think that was kind of a clickbaity headline. I think that the – I think Felix was frustrated with himself that his performance was not – like, was not up to the standards of being the day one pitcher for the team. I don't think he's, like – I don't – Felix, for the many things that I wish he did differently in terms of keeping himself physically fit and – learning how to pitch differently so as to have a longer career than he appears to, you know, be on the way to having. I don't think he was, like, butthurt that they're not – like, he's not an idiot. He doesn't think they should be starting him day one if he's, like, you know, floundering in spring training. I think he's mad at himself. And I – but when I read the headline, I thought it sounded like he was mad at the team, and I don't think that's the case.
I disagree.
Oh,
I was
okay.
Pretty immersed in this yesterday, and it's kind of funny because this is what this was a bit that Mike Salk was doing on the show yesterday. He's like, he must be mad at himself, right? Like kind of comedically and falsely giving King Felix the benefit of the doubt, saying, but like he didn't say much in this grumpy interview. I mean, he just had terrible, terrible spring training outing. And then, you know, a reporter, I don't know who, asks him in a very noisy locker room. It's kind of hard to hear the tape and he's kind of grunting. But like they ask him about like how he feels about not starting. He's like, you know, not great. And then he says something like no comment. And then, somebody asked, do you think that this spring could have changed things? And he essentially says no. Like, he gave an answer that made it sound like their mind was made up before the spring and I never had a shot. I think he's butthurt. I don't think that he does see the reality. Wow. But maybe, I mean, you know what? It's a complicated thing. Interview, he doesn't speak English as a first language. I mean, he's been here for a long time. He speaks good English. But, you know, it's a noisy locker room. He's grumpy. It's really hard to read somebody's mind in this scenario, but
yeah,
no, I do think that he feels like he's not getting the respect he deserves. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know. Maybe that's also colored by my own just kind of frustration with him. So
I didn't realize this, but he was the day one starter for 10 seasons for a decade. And that's some kind of record. And it kind of, it was, you know, that's impressive. I think he should be proud of that. There's an argument that says, look, this team is gonna be worse at baseball than Yotam Haber is at driving a sled dog team. Like, let him. Who cares? Let him do day one. Whatever. He gave you 10 years of hard work. For 8 of those years, he was arguably the most dominant pitcher in baseball. I mean, look, the season is totaled. If I called up my actual insurance agent, Kevin O'Brien, and I said, hi, I have a Seattle Mariners, and I showed him the team, I would say, and by the way, Kyle Seager's out for a minimum of a month.
I know.
Oh, thanks for getting in shape, Kyle. I love this story. It must be so. These are the dark days of being a baseball writer. Yeah, we're just doing this. This is fine. This is okay. This is perfectly fine. The listeners are in that meme where the whole house is on fire. This is fine. This is fine.
Right.
Like, it is a dark days for being a baseball writer because you have to write stories like Kyle Seager coming into camp 20 pounds lighter and ready for action. And it's like,
yeah.
To what end? Like, it's just, there's so many inches so many column inches to fill with stories about a baseball team that is just going to stink on ice. And, like, you have to act like Kyle Seager, notable underachiever Kyle Seager, is ready for action this year. Like, it's just brutal. And then he's hurt. I mean, he's not even going to play.
You talk about the baseball writers for, like, let's say legitimate news organizations, but then think about the people who have to write for, like, the MLB app. Like, I have the Mariners as my you know, home screen team when I open up that app, and so they have to have headlines that are completely positive and just, you know, like, they're writing for the league. They want people to be engaged, and that's right. Where I saw the thin Kyle Seager is back and ready for action. And then think about the promo makers at, like, 710 ESPN. Like, I have a dark web theory, a conspiracy theory, that they had to keep Haniger only for the promo makers, because without Haniger, you literally have no promo tape, like, that at all mentions any positive Mariner. Like, you just have no tape from previous seasons that you can be, like, those bullshit promos where it's like,
right,
that's right, guys, it's time, he steps up to the plate. And, you know, I really hate those Mariners promos anyway, mm-hmm. where they're just, like, making it sound like it's just, like, the ultimate in competition. And you're like, wow, we haven't won a game in 4 weeks. That's
Anthony Swarzak and the Mariners roll into Baltimore looking to keep their ERA below six.
Exactly.
You get it. It's like, what? I mean, maybe
let me read you an email that you're going to ignore, but the person really, really, really wants me to read it to you. This is from Jamie. For real, please be careful. People are allowed to hunt. Oh, this is regarding you hiking on timber company land. Luke, please read. All caps. For real, please be careful. People are allowed to hunt with state permits, and many companies permit hunting either freely or with a permit. So if you aren't positive where you are and that there's no hunting, wear orange and maybe even put orange on Rudy. The problem with random access isn't the company. It's other people who are leasing it or are permitting the land. They will report you for trespassing if they aren't shooting at you. So
I appreciate Jamie. Thank you. I know Jamie works for a major timber concern. She puts the concern in timber concern. I saw a lot of no hunting signs actually posted. I did hear someone hunting on a different mountain, though. It's weird. Mm. Like, I don't know if they were – I don't think they were hunting. I think they were target shooting because it was, like, pretty repetitive. I feel like hunting would be a couple shots every 2 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. This was like somebody was shooting at a stump or something in their back in their property. It's very bassy, that the sound of, like, gunfire from far away. It sounds kind of like a minor explosion, which I guess is technically what it is. It sounds nothing like in the movies, which is where most of my knowledge of how gunfire sounds comes from. But there are a lot of no hunting signs around, and I don't think it's private property. I think it's maintained by the Department of Natural Resources, and it also has some Bureau of Land Management aspect to it. It did not say, like, Weyerhaeuser or Simpson or, like, one of these big timber companies, but it is a good note, listener Jamie, because I do plan to hike around on all of these mountains. And I will, you know what I have? I have a very bright green jacket and hat that I got in a white elephant family thing from Boeing. It's called, like, Goal Zero, which I think means they were trying to have, like, zero on-the-job injuries. And step one was making very bright day-glow green outfits for people. And I will wear that. And Rudy's on her own. Rudy's just going to have to figure it out. Sorry.
Yeah.
Life lessons. But Jamie, I appreciate the heads up. Can I read an email from a listener, Steve, about the dryer smell that really has me thinking?
Yeah. I don't think I got this one.
Listener Steve says, Luke, I think you mentioned in passing what might be the root cause of the smell. You said the attic was above the dryer. Well, if there's a dead animal in the attic, then when the dryer runs, it, being a pump that sends hot, wet air outside, mm-hmm. it pulls mm-hmm. the makeup air partly from the attic, which would bring you the smell. Mm-hmm. Steve in Bellevue. There's some logic to that, because
but it's not like you live with a little creature that used to have access to the outdoors and the attic and would possibly bring a dead animal up there.
whose actual nickname is based around the practice.
Right.
Right. Like, the dryer is, I didn't think about it until listener Steve pointed out, the dryer is kind of an intake outflow thing. It's drawing air in from somewhere so as to then, you know, heat that air up, dry the thing, and then push that air out the vent. And so if it's a big, you know, if it's sucking air, that air is coming from somewhere and maybe it's drawing air down. So what this means is, I got to go up in the attic, Chevy Chase Christmas Vacation style, and look around, see if there's something dead above the dryer. Or, Andrew, and I'm voting for this approach, just live with it until whatever is up there mummifies to the point where it doesn't have a smell anymore.
I know that you don't share this phenomenon, but the idea of creeping around in an attic, possibly with a flashlight, looking to see if there might be an old dead animal in there, that is 100% make me need to poop territory.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that sounds fun to you, and I was going to offer you money to come do it.
I've tried to explain to you before, and some listeners have sent in, like there's various things about this theory about, like, why some people have to go to the bathroom the second they're in a bookstore. For me, it's like a bookstore or a CD store or something like that. I just have to go to the bathroom almost immediately. And then also creeping around in attics and basements just makes me need to go to the bathroom immediately. Huh.
It really, we have a lot of bathrooms.
It really soiled my my hide and seek game as a kid.
Because
if I was the one hiding, I just had to go to the bathroom right away. They always knew where to find me in the bathroom.
Hide and seek was a weird one. I loved hide and seek as a kid, but I feel like getting the right amount of hiding is the hard part, because you want to be like, okay, the platonic ideal of a hide for hide and seek is you're hiding somewhere and the person looking for you is like walking past you but not seeing you, or walking below you. You're basically like, it's like Inglourious Bastards and you're under the floor and Christoph Waltz is like walking on top of you. Because if you're too well hid and they can't find you, then eventually they're just like, okay, come out wherever you are. Or if you're not well hid enough, they find you immediately. Like, you just got to be kind of right in the sweet spot. Because a number of times I would find a hiding spot that was really good, and then I would just be hanging out by myself in an enclosed space for a number of hours.
Right. Well, I mean, also as an unpopular kid, I feel like there were also times when they wouldn't look for me. I mean, I don't have any specific memories of that, but that strikes true to me, that you just be like, okay, well, that's one way to kind of weed out the kids you don't want to hang out with.
I guess. We would play hide and seek in our house sometimes, me and my little sisters, which is like hilarious because there's like seven kids. And when I was a kid growing up in Seattle, it was a 3-bedroom house. There wasn't that much, one bathroom. There just wasn't that much area to hide for that many kids, but we would, and it was fun. We also once, for a period of time, we had an enormous, Andrew, I'm talking like 6-7 feet off the ground, rocking horse in our side yard, that when it was the craziest thing ever. Did I tell you the story of Ramsey, the kid with the mohawk?
I don't think so.
So when I was a kid, we would go to Matthews Beach, which is like a beach on Lake Washington. We would walk there from our house near Northgate. And my mom is just, you know, I think credit, I guess. My mom is very open to the universe and to people in a way that I am not. Like, she's just kind of, you know, down for whatever when it comes to making new friends. And at the beach, she made friends with this woman named Valerie, who Valerie and her son lived in a mail truck. This was before Sprinter vans were a thing, but let me tell you, they had this thing tricked out. It was like a postal truck, you know, the kind that you would see driving around delivering the mail. But she had tricked out the inside, so there was a bed in the back. The whole thing was basically a bed, and then this whole elaborate system of hooks. So everything was hung up inside the kind of, you know, inside the back of the truck. And they would like... they would sleep in there, and then they would use the bathroom at Denny's. The Denny's on Aurora that I believe is, or on Lake City that I believe is now a tanning salon, which is that's a hard pivot for a retail space. Like, it's an enormous tanning center if it was a Denny's before. But
yeah.
Anyway, her name was Valerie Ramsey, and her son's name, wait for it, was Ramsey Ramsey. She named her son Ramsey, and his last name was Ramsey, and he had a mohawk, and I was just like, is any of this real? Like, my mind was fully blown as about a seven-year-old kid.
The kid's so great, we had to name him twice.
That's right. Ramsey Ramsey. And so this lady, we had a lot of people like this in our life. This woman would kind of float in and out of our life periodically. So they had the mail truck parked in front of our house for some period of time, and then eventually they floated on. And then years later, she resurfaced. She was living in basically like a retail space on Greenwood Avenue, kind of by the Pig and Whistle and by where Neptune Coffee was before it blew up. And I don't mean got more popular. I mean literally exploded. And the deal with this space she was living in, she was now a painter. And the space was, you're not really supposed to live there. She had rented it as her office to do painting in.
Yeah.
But she also lived there at night. Like she had like a hide-a-bed. So I remember going over there. And now Ramsey, I remember Ramsey may have gone to live with his dad or something. There was no more Ramsey Ramsey in sight. But I remember this kind of space she had and thinking, this is kind of cool. So I guess you can live in an office, right on. And then a couple more years go by, and one day she shows up at our house with this rocking horse that is – I can't overstate it. It's like the part you sit on was 5.5 feet off the ground, if not 6 feet off the ground. You had to climb up a series of pegs on the side of the rocking horse to get on top of it. It was all made out of wood, and when you would rock on it, you were way up in the air. And we had like – our yard was so small because we lived in Seattle by Aurora Avenue. But we had this friggin' rocking horse in our side yard for like years. And it was so much fun. And I was like, cool, we get this rocking horse now. And then one day she showed up to repo her rocking horse. And I was just like, really? Where are you taking this? After 3 years, like, I don't know if she had built it or traded for it, but I don't know what the point of that story was, Andrew, but that rocking horse was freaking cool.
There's some dazzling damn deets in there, though. God, I just looked up Ramsey Ramsey really quickly. It does look like there's somebody named Ramsey Ramsey on Facebook, but I cannot access it. Because
does he have a mohawk? It's probably the same guy.
I can't get in at all. It's totally locked me out now.
See, that's what you get for... Oh, I forgot to tell you.
I can't stalk people.
Happy... What do you call the day when you no longer... are on Facebook. Happy Conscious Uncoupling Day. That was last week, right?
You did the same thing, right? Like, I had disabled my account for a long time, and then I was finally like, I'm just, just one more news story. I'm just like, screw this. I want nothing to do with this company anymore. So I decided I would actually delete it, and then it said, okay, but we're going to give you 60 days. I think it was a full 60 days, right, to think about this, and then we will delete it on, March 7th, I think. And
yes.
March 7th came and went, and so, yeah, I have no
I know, and I meant I to wish no you a happy birthday on that day, or a happy whatever we call it.
I want to wish you an unhappy Facebook. Hey, this is completely self-serving, but as you would say,
is it rocking horse related? Because that's the only content I'm interested in for the rest of the show.
This is totally unrelated, totally self-serving. I will be embarrassed that I did this on the show later, but that's kind of my MO. I got a tweet from listener Deborah, who said, hey, congratulations on the shout out in the AV Club for Spotless.
What?
Of course, the podcast I do with Hannah Brooks Olsen. So then I looked, and I just right now where you're telling your rocking horse story, but I was listening as well. But
that's fine.
So the AV Club has a segment called Podmass, where it looks like they highlight a whole bunch of pods. So it is a listicle, but they actually gave us a decent little write. So the headline is Inside Conan Serves Up the Nuts and Bolts of Comedy for True Late Night Dork. So it's like, it's really that's the lead.
Lead with the Conan. Feed with the Spotless, okay?
I mean, exactly.
They got to get him in there with the Conan, but the real interesting content is Spotless related.
That's right, and it does look like all of this was written. Okay. So they get various people to write up episodes or podcasts that they like. So let me I just scanned this a tiny bit, but I actually have not even read this. So this could be embarrassing if they have any takedowns in here as well. But if you don't mind, I'm going to read to you directly from the AV Club. There's an enjoyable meta quality to listening to podcasts while actually doing the thing the podcast is about. If you're into that sort of thing, grab a sponge and listen to Spotless because you will get shit done. Before Marie Kondo made... See? My name in the same graph as Marie Kondo. There you go.
You're using a galaxy.
Dear Hannah. Okay. Before Marie Kondo made tidying up cool, hosts Hannah Brooke Olsen and Andrew Walsh were initiating fellow scrub jockeys into the cult of clever and apparently controversial cleaning hacks like freezing your jeans and using vodka as a miracle cleaner. This episode, I guess they're talking about an episode called Dust Ups and Royal Flushes. This episode is their most provocative yet, with hot takes on everything from dusting with dryer sheets to how to deal with that nasty soup on the bottom of your toilet brush holders, which you don't and do want to know all about. What makes this podcast shine is the host's ability to get to the roots of their own psychological hang-ups related to cleaning, stressing out over matching bath mats and towels, recoiling when looking at piles of unread newspapers, or feeling guilt when your partner announces that it's really time to wash the sheets. Millennial burnout is real, but Olsen and Walsh tackle it with charm, making you feel like everything's going to be okay as long as everything is clean. Written by Amber Cortez. That's a really nice goddamn write-up in the AV Club. That's sweet.
Congratulations.
You got to scroll down pretty far, but it's in there.
Hey, nice. That's awesome, man. Congrats.
That makes me happy, yeah. Now let's watch the numbers roll in.
That's right. Actually, I mean, that is, seriously, though, like, the AV Club is... very much a that's the fresh air. If you're a writer, you got to get your book on Fresh Air. If you're a podcaster, you got to get mentioned in the AV Club, because I think a lot of people do go to the AV Club for their recommendations because it's so overwhelming at this point, the sheer number of podcasts. So that's like a very useful recommendation to have. Congratulations, man. That's awesome.
That's really nice. And also, it's just like a really, really nice write-up. It's just like, it's so rare that I hear somebody, aside from, like, you know, something that we pushed out via a PR department with, like,
something
a
that we wrote
me.
Through a dummy Twitter account.
Yeah. Right. As something that I wrote on a, you know, on a Reddit channel somewhere about, well, have you guys checked out this podcast?
Isn't
I really
that funny
like
when,
it.
Like, you hear about, like, you know, Kevin Durant clapping back via like a fake Instagram or Twitter, and it's just like, I can promise to the listeners there's no chance of us ever trying any kind of subterfuge like that, because that would just be so much more work than we're willing to do.
Like, yeah, right.
To go to like to make a fake account of some kind to then write up something vaguely positive about, say, TBTL or whatever. Like, it's not even that I'm morally opposed to it, it's just that, like, who has the time?
The sad thing is, and I don't feel this way now, but there was a time, I think, when I could probably see myself going down that. Like, it's just amazing what a sinkhole that be.
Particularly
for anybody,
like,
I think,
job,
personally.
You feel like your job or your chances of this becoming a job rest on it, like this idea of, like, you got to be out there. You got to be, like, you know. You got to be on social, and you got to be promoting everything, and you got to be, like, you know, it's just, it starts to feel almost like it's like you're floating in an ocean of anonymity and unpopularity, and the lifeline is somehow controlling the narrative and getting the mentions and the likes and the reposts and all this. It can make you totally crazy, because it starts to feel like, well, if I just do that, if I just grind away at that hard enough, then this will be a success. And I have to say that, like, I'm not any closer to actually really getting this book project into a real existence than I have been for the last 10 years. Although I did actually do some work on the proposal when I was in Joshua Tree, and I actually kind of like it. It's better. It's interesting writing when I'm not wasted. I think it's, you know, what, there's less racially dicey stuff, so I guess that's good. but, no, like, I had this thought. I was like, if I ever do write a book – or I guess this is the most direct example. If I ever write a book, I swear to you, this is my promise to you right now and to the listeners, I will never tweet about it. I will never, because I don't think, because you and I are both friends with, and I don't say this to be, I'm not trying to be snarky about anybody else's projects. And I have retweeted my friend's projects because I get it. Like, you, the publisher or whomever is just telling you, like, you know, you got to get the word out there. But, like, I am of the opinion that I don't think it makes an appreciable difference. Like, I don't think I've ever interacted with a product. I don't think I've ever bought a book because I saw somebody tweeting about it. And, like, it's this to me is kind of connected to what you were saying about how, like, you could see us actually maybe writing a fake review in iTunes or something to try to, like, I don't know, goose the numbers or seed the clouds, as it were. Because it's just, you get really crazy because you're just like, I want to be successful, and this is a way that it can maybe work. I know that people get told, like, you got to just, like, flog your project. And there's varying degrees. If you're putting on a play and you're trying to get 100 people to come to it over a weekend and you have 100 followers on Twitter in your town, that is a very reasonable place to tell people about the thing you're doing. I'm not trying to say that people should not promote themselves. But I'm just saying, for me personally, I've watched good men die on the hill of self-promotion. And I just, like, I honestly, if I wrote a book and it sold 10 copies, but I did not force everyone to constantly see me retweeting people talking about my book, I could be okay with that. Because I think me doing all that thirst would lead to 20 copies selling, which would not be enough of an improvement for, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I wonder, because here's the deal. I personally am much like you. Like, I don't want to seem thirsty at all. I do, like, with, you know, with Spotless or After These Messages or something, I will every now and then, like, post out a like a link to our latest show. But I actually try, specifically don't do that for every show, because who wants to follow a Twitter feed that is nothing but here's the new show? I mean, that's just exhausting, and it seems like it's not very productive. Every now and then I'm like, oh, this is a good show, let's do it, and it feels like I should do that. But anyway, that's just small potatoes, my little podcasting things. But on a broader scale, I will say I have mixed emotions about what you said, because some people do it and it does seem like a turnoff. It seems very thirsty, and I think, how can you just not get exhausted with yourself doing that all the time? Then I see other people who do it, I just think, really well. And I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to call one person out, and that is our friend Nora McInerney, Nora Borealis on Twitter, and I believe that's her name also on Instagram too. And, like, she is just so good, especially on Instagram, of just creating a whole Nora universe. And I mean, I hate to use the word brand, because God, you know why I hate to use that word. But, like, she just, you know, the way that she is very confessional on there, she will do these Instagram stories, and she will also let you know that, hey, I got this new book coming out. And she definitely, you know, tweets and or Instagrams about her book a lot, but it's all in the context of that you feel like you're also kind of in this club that she's created. I almost feel like, you know, like Nora is doing across multiple platforms, kind of what you and I are doing just in the podcast space, sort of, which is kind of creating our own universe and our own language and our own kind of members only club, sort of. And I just see
we're
her
getting members
that,
only jackets too. Yes, those are on order.
Exactly. And then the other thing I'll say, which isn't related to just her and people who do that well, I don't follow tons of famous people on those platforms, but the few that I do, I realize that if they are good at, you know, posting all kinds of things, but also reminding you of their projects, those projects really do seep into your consciousness. Like,
sure.
I wouldn't know.
Paul F. Tompkins is a really good example of that, I think.
Perfect example. And, like, so, and also Taffy Brodesser Ackner. Like, I know that she's got a new book coming out. Maybe it's actually out now. And I've actually been dying to read it. And I wouldn't know about it except that I follow her on Twitter. So, in some cases, I completely agree with you. Like, I see some people do things, I'm like, I don't want to be that guy. And I also just don't have it in me, energy-wise or emotionally, to be self-promoting. But then other people do it, and I realize it does have an impact on me, and it will send me out to get a book. So I don't know.
Well, I think really what I think as we talk about it, and so often is the case on the show, that, like, in talking it out, I think I get down to the root of what's going on for me. I think for me it's probably – I have a fear that if I were to create something like a book, it would be unsuccessful – And so for my way of insulating myself against that is to write it but then not try. It's the same way that like my Twitter bio has no identifying information other than my name, because I feel like there's just something – I mean, do I want more people to go to my Twitter feed and then be like, oh, TBTL, let me listen to that, or Livewire? Yes, of course. I desperately want that. But I don't – I see people whose Twitter bios is just like 8,000 things, or like – or they're promoting a thing that I'm kind of like, I don't know if I'd be promoting that. Like, and that – gives me a bad feeling, so I tend to opt out of it, not because I'm not driven by the same things, because I am, but because I don't want to seem like I'm driven by the same things. So I think I think there's just a few people that I follow and that I'm friends with who it tipped over into, like, every single tweet from them was something related to their book, and it just became kind of it became kind of, you know, one note. And I think I saw that and I thought, my angle is going to be zero promotion, which is totally dumb. Back to the Paul F. Tompkins example. Paul is like, he creates lots of really great content on Twitter. And he also tells you if, like, you know, Spontanea Nation or Threedom is coming to a town near you, which is great because he's probably got like a million Twitter followers. Like, why would you not want to tell those folks that you're coming to Austin or whatever? Like, it only makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to act like I'm above. I retweet things all the time about TBTL or about Livewire or what have you, about, like, only pieces that I've done for CBS that involve Rudy. Those are the only ones I'm proud of. So I hope that it doesn't sound like I'm trying to say I'm above self-promotion. I think what I'm realizing is I've decided that, like, my way of preserving some last shred of dignity around this book that I still haven't written is to act like I don't care if anyone buys it. That's my move, because then if nobody buys it, I feel like I'm cool. You know, something I've really been thinking about a lot lately, though, is, and this is kind of, I guess you would say, ironic, because for a long time, a lot of my anxiety around Livewire was about audience attendance. We do the show, and it was always like, are we going to sell the show out, or are we going to half sell the theater, or are we going to have to give away a bunch of tickets, or what? And that was a really big point of, like, insecurity for me, and it drove a lot of the decisions, and I would have this building anxiety all week about, like, how many tickets are we selling. And then we got a much better management operation going. Our executive producer Laura Haddon is just a dream and so friggin' smart and organized that we now pretty much sell out every show. So maybe that's helping me. But what I realized was, you know who the person most obsessed with audience turnout is? Donald J. fucking Trump. Like, that guy, all he cares about is how many people came to his rally. And I've really been trying to think to myself, is that the kind of person I want to be? Like, do I want people to be like, who work with me, to be like, yeah, Luke, he's pretty good at hosting Livewire. He's, you know, quick on his feet and everything. Boy, what he really cares about, though, is if the show sells out. He just, it's like, you know who would not be okay doing a show to 10 people? Donald Trump. So that means I should really get okay with it real fast. Because, like, any characteristic he has, I don't want to have. And something about thinking about how obsessed he is with inflating and lying about the number of people that have attended this, that, or the other. Like, it's so obvious that it's just a very, like, physical manifestation of this need to be liked. You're like, oh, if there's 1,000 people here, I'm being liked. Like, to see him operating along that way, it's really good for me, because it helps me be like, I don't care. We can have 2 people show up. I'm going to have a fun time and do the show. And this is an act of protest from me to the current president of the United States.
What's going on with your exploratory committee, by the way? Are you still, you know,
I'm not at liberty to actually talk about that yet, but I'm just, really, you know what I'm doing, Andrew? I'm out.
Are you listening?
I'm listening to people.
Are you listening?
I'm just finding out if reading Bartles and James flavors is something that resonates with the American people.
Is that considered a platform? I am on the Bartles and James flavor list and platform.
Is Razzleberry Delight an important issue to the American voters?
All right. Okay. Let's see. Did you write down any show titles? I wrote down Repo the Rocking Horse, which actually makes it sound like it's the rocking horse's name.
Is it named Repo?
Sort of like,
we don't know. I never even asked. Somebody told me that horse didn't just love rocking, it needed to rock. which I thought was I had my questions, but I didn't even get the horse's name. So what? I can't talk
that's,
shit.
Oh man, that's pretty good. We could also name it. Yeah, instead of Repo Man, we can name the show Repo Horse. Or I wrote down putting metadata into the internet part of the show, which maybe was funnier when I was tireder. I don't know. What do you like?
I think Repo the Rocking Horse.
Okay.
I kind of like it, and if people are confused, force them to listen 2 hours into the show to figure out what the heck we were talking about.
You mentioned that sometimes. I wonder, like, has there any ever been somebody who's kind of like, well, I wasn't going to listen to this podcast, but you know what? Now I really need to figure it. Like, has anybody clicked on us just based on the title? I kind of find that hard to believe,
well,
but I don't
look,
know.
The last newsletter, when you broke out those old titles, you were reading those to me off air, and
yeah.
I was legit laughing aloud. Like, I think that some of those, my point isn't that I think people would listen to the show because of the title. My point is people would listen to the whole show trying to figure out when the heck do they get – like, this is people that are already – you know, these are parishioners that are already in the church. Like, they're
right.
listening, and maybe they're like, wait, when did Repo – I'm an hour and a half into this. No mention of Repo the Rocking Horse. What is going on?
These are
on?
The people who would usually leave right after communion, but they've decided to stick around for the
That's
end.
Right, because
remember,
they want to
my family
out.
Was very judgy about those people. Because I know that you didn't grow up in the Catholic tradition, there would be the people who would leave right at – because, like, the Eucharist is near the end of the Mass, right? And
yeah.
then you would take communion, and then there would be kind of a – I believe what they call specifically in the liturgy a wrap-up. A wrap-up show, and then and then whatever. And so
hello?
I think figured that they don't.
Sorry, that's I'm
only laughing because I'm laughing because I heard you and Phyllis talking about that the other day. Anyway, so my family would be very judgy about the people who would be, you know, kind of last in, first
that's
out.
That's such an interesting kind of level of clearly the people that would get communion and get out of there. They very much believe that communion is an important thing. Like, they think it is mm-hmm. like transubstantiation is happening and this is necessary, which is so interesting because it's like, then they didn't stay for the rest of it. It's very transactional in a way. It's like, I got to get here. I got to get the body and the blood in me. And then I got to get back out to sinning until next week.
Right. That's
right?
Exactly what they said. Do you know that I learned something recently? And I'm trying – why am I extending the show into a place that I'm not? So, you know, transubstantiation is the belief that you're turning, you know, literally the bread into the body of Christ and the wine into the blood of Christ. That's what transubstantiation means. It's not symbolic. It's supposed to be literal.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm still, I should not admit this because people can probably track. Go back about 100 episodes and I'll mention that I started reading a new book called Wolf Hall that takes place during the reign of Henry VIII, all through the eyes of Thomas Cromwell. And it is by far the most difficult book I've read, probably as an adult, because it gives you no real context. Constantly flipping to the front and remembering who characters are, and it doesn't hold your hand through anything, but it's also just really well written. It's by far the best, hardest book I've ever read, and it's taken me forever to read it, and I'm kind of embarrassed about that. But one of the reasons it takes so long is they'll just drop something in and you're like, what is the context here? And one of the things that kind of sent me on a bit of a rabbit hole when I was supposed to be reading the book was they mentioned that there was somebody who was a Lawler, Lollar, who was burned at the stake for her beliefs. I'm like, well, what is a Lawler? And they believe in something that is not transubstantiation, but is something very close to it called consubstantiation, where they believe it is both the bread and the body at the same time, and it's both wine and the blood at the same time.
They're concurrently transubstantiating, or they're concurrently substantiating. They're being both
right
at the same time.
But these seemingly small divisions in the church lead to people who are willing to both burn people alive and be burned alive. Like, I can't get over that. Like, I had to put the book down and just, like, dig into this fucking lollardliness because, like, it is just so beyond my, you know, and again, like, I am an atheist in 2019. Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to, you know, contextualize what was going on with the church and splits in the church in the 1550s. But I just got so hung up on that there's this thing called consubstantiation, which is just off a half a click from transubstantiation, right. And people were being burned for it, and people weren't lying about it. I guess that's the key,
they bring
so
out the
many
first torch, and I'm like, you know what? Trans.
You know what? I'm feeling more literal today.
As I'm sitting here, as I'm tied here, I am really thinking it might literally be the body and the blood and not the bread still.
You know what? I get it. It's like one of those things where it doesn't click until you've heard it 40 times. So anyway.
Now, there are also anti-Lawlers. There are people that think that Jerry the King Lawler did not actually defeat Kerry Von Erich at Super Clash 3, thus unifying the various title belts. The WCWA World Heavyweight Champion.
So you have read this.
How much of it is about pro wrestling?
I haven't gotten to that part yet.
Okay,
I had
an idea for music. My daughter just texted me and said, she goes, did you know that Summer Teeth turned 20 years old the other day?
I was like, wait, the band or the people in the band?
The Wilco album, Summer Teeth.
Oh, I thought that was that band from Ohio that she turned us on to. That was Summer something else. Oh, Summer
Probably.
Teeth, the album is 20 years
the
old.
The album
okay,
Summer
yeah.
Teeth by Wilco turned 20 years old recently, which, you know, this is just going to happen more and more. But that makes me feel really old.
Yeah,
so I was thinking, what if we played a song off of Summer Teeth? Like, I'm a big fan of the track I'm Always in Love.
Okay, cool. I don't know this record, so I don't think I've really ever even listened to it.
Unless,
man. Like, songs here and there. I think somebody might have put the song. Is there a song called Summer Teeth? Because I feel like somebody put that on a mix for me at some point.
Yeah, there's no way that being, like, if you're a white person who went to college, there's no way Wilco is not on a mixtape you got or mix CD. Like,
right,
of a certain age. Like, this is just in the water supply of people like us, as it were. You know what I mean? Like, they were just so kind of they had such a moment, particularly when that documentary came out. But I just feel like if you were in mix, let me put it this way. If you were in mixtape culture at all of indie bands, there's definitely some Wilco popped up somewhere. So this song, I'm Always in Love. I it was the one song I was allowed to sing in our Wilco cover band.
Oh,
right. Roger. So it's got a real special place in my heart. All right, nice. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to be back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. Until then, have a great Tuesday, and please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
Feeling goes, but my hair keeps growing. Will I set the sun on a big wheel wagon?
Power out.